Once more onto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and Jake McClure. Arg.
If you make Henry V, a great English Shakespearean play, and you just put some Scottish accents about there, closing up the wall with their English
Let's
dead.
Close up the wall with those bloody English dead.
Oh, yes.
That would be the way to do it, you know. I mean, if you're going to close up a wall, don't do it with Americans or Scots.
Unless you're English, and then it's not so fun.
Well, what else is going on in the big wide world?
Let's see.
Corporate income tax.
Well, I was going to talk about that, too, actually.
That really?
Is like we have...
Two great minds.
And ours as well.
One of the things that's happened to the corporate income tax is the revenues that are actually flowing into the Treasury Department from the corporate income tax world are not growing as fast as everything else is. And matter of fact, sometimes it actually shrinks a little bit. And there's a reason for that. There's a process going on whereby companies that are based in the United States are working very, very hard at finding ways to become based somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it boils down to the fact that, for example, across Europe, the average income tax right now is around corporate income tax is around 20-21%.
Right.
Ours is 35%. And, of course,
that's a little bit higher.
We have a lot of deductions and loopholes and a lot of things. And it's a very complicated system like the personal income tax.
But it's expensive to do that.
Right. And it creates a distortion in what's going on. And it also is the reason, for whatever it's worth, that we see corporations sitting on huge piles of cash.
Sitting overseas, yeah.
Because it's overseas, because if they bring it back here, they've already paid their 21% tax on it somewhere else. And if they bring it back here, they have to pay the difference between the 21 and the 35. So they basically will get taxed again, over 10%, even with deductions. So they're going to wind up paying over 10% just to bring money back to the United States. So what they've started doing... And this is a little awkward for us, and they'd rather not do it, is they're having to, if they're going to invest that money, they need to invest it somewhere other than in the United States, because
it would cost a lot of money. Well, I mean, you got to make
an interesting point here. We have a 10% penalty for early withdrawal from an IRA, and
right.
That does a very good job of keeping people
from taking money out of
their IRA.
Yeah.
And when we impose a 10% penalty on returning money to the United States on corporations, we shouldn't be unduly surprised to find out that they choose not to do so.
Right. And any effort made by Congress, when they keep making noises about it, to close those loopholes, to make it so that overseas you have to spend it as well, all that will do is a very similar thing to what's happening when they tell Americans that live overseas that you've got to pay extra taxes just because you're an American. They stop being American.
You have a record number of people who give up their citizenship.
And what will happen is corporations do not have souls. Well, they may be people according to the Supreme Court, and they're made up of lots of people. The people that they're made up of want to see profits. And if the United States says that you cannot have as many profits if you're based in the United States as if you're based somewhere else, there's some point where we say, well, that's okay, it's worth it to be an American. But at some point, the line gets crossed where it's costing so much more money to be an American company that they decide not to be an American company anymore.
And one of the issues in Congress... Well, the issue in Congress with this is, by the way, both sides, the Democrats and the Republicans, agree that the corporate income tax is screwed up. But this is where things break down rather quickly. The Democrats, generally speaking, say we need to close a lot of loopholes in the tax
right.
and lower it a little bit.
A little bit. Well, that's not enough. You got to lower it
a
lot.
Well, on the other side, you have the Republicans say do away with it completely.
Right. Well, that's not going to work either.
And because they've taken these strong positions, they can't compromise. And when they can't compromise, nothing happens. And as a result, a bad situation stays in place. And there's no – the way it's being fixed is by corporations leaving the United States.
In a perfect world, the government gets its revenue because people exist, and it doesn't hurt the people to give the revenue to the government because it's just part of their normal transaction process. And it's sort of happened with the income tax, in that mm-hmm. most people don't even know that they're paying the tax anymore. It's not even in their paycheck.
Right.
If you're self-employed, then you start realizing, no, this is not painless. This hurts a lot because I may have wanted to spend that money next year, but because I didn't spend it by the end of the year, I have to pay taxes on it so that next year I've been saving that money so that I could buy a piece of equipment, which is a significant cost to the business. But because I didn't do it this year, I have to pay taxes on the money that I was saving for it. Anyway, that's a problem. It's a major problem. And in a perfect world, we would apply the same kind of thing to a corporation as you do to most people that work in the United States, which is you don't even know you're paying the tax. It just happens.
Well,
you go about doing it. And
there's a reason you don't know you're paying the tax other than the withholding.
What's that?
The Laffer principle, if you want to call it the Laffer point.
Yeah.
But going back even to biblical times, in the Old Testament,
three tithes.
There are three tithes, 30% total tax. And the two of the three tithes were to the equivalent of the federal government, the temple.
Right, the temple. And then one of them was to yourself.
Well, one of them was to the local storehouse. So basically you had the effect of local property taxes taking 10%. Property taxes, sales taxes, and so on.
Right, by yourself, I mean like the Social Security of the day, which is the local storehouse.
And then you had the 20% going to the government. Well, actually, it works out in the United States that 18% going to the federal government works out almost ideally.
Right.
And then you wind up spending a lot of other money on taxes to the local government, which amounts to about 12%. So we wind up, on average, giving up about 30% of our profits after we do the deductions that are allowed.
But that doesn't leave room for the local storehouse.
Right.
If you throw Social Security in there.
Well, that includes Social Security. You're spending half the 20% that we pay to the government is split between Social Security /Medicare and income taxes.
I've got different figures, but we can discuss that another time. What you're saying is, in for the purpose of the principle of the issue, is quite clear. It's correct.
When you talk revenues coming into the federal government, by the way, it does include the Social Security money that comes in, I think.
Well,
about
the revenues do, but yeah, the
anyway.
When I look at the numbers that I show for corporate and income tax revenue is that 18 figure when you're talking about the what they would call payroll taxes, that puts it up into a much higher realm. And then if you add local, state, and so on there, you get way up in
there. Well, the point I wanted to make is, if you start with a 35% tax to corporations, and recognizing that the corporations are matching part of that money that goes to Social Security, half the money that goes to Social Security and so on, comes out of the corporate coffer, not out of the individual pay.
Right.
So you automatically throw in a big chunk of money there.
Right. The corporation's already paying a big chunk.
And then they pay property taxes and excise taxes and a host of other things.
Right.
The end result is the corporate tax burden is over the Laffer point. And,
yes.
And so by leaving it as high as it is,
it's,
you get diminished revenues.
Yeah. And when we're talking about the personal income tax and the corporate income tax, in order for a corporation to pay its shareholders, to give money directly to the shareholders, there's a way of doing that. They call them dividends. Well, dividends can only be paid after the corporate income tax has been paid. So they pay that 35%. Well, if you take all the loopholes that might exist and you drop that down out of there, then you're really talking about closer to 28%. They pay 28% taxes if they have a good tax team. If they have a mediocre tax team, then you're talking 32% taxes. All right. So what is a corporation? A corporation, the Supreme Court said it a couple of times, it's a person. Well, if it's a person, and basically they're saying that because of all the people involved in owning it, then there should be a direct pass-through of that money to the owner. Instead, there's a tax on it. Then it's passed through to the owner. Well, then the owner has to pay a tax on it. And if you're just your typical American citizen, we're already saying that you're paying that 18 point whatever percent plus your other things. Well, you got to lay that on top of it as well. So the what's actually happening with any revenue made by an American corporation, if they're making any almost any revenue at all, they're going to be at the they're getting up into that highest tax bracket. Then they're paying those dividends out to the people, and the dividends are taxed as income. So what you really have happen is you have close to a 40% taxation on the profits of a corporation if they're going to be used to be spent in the United States. And that's insane.
Mm-hmm.
That's just insane.
Well, you know, the issue is that we need to make some adjustments there or we're going to damage ourselves. So if you want to do, if you have an opportunity, by the way, going for a zero corporate income tax, which is the Republican and apparently Tea Party ideal.
If we're talking about ideals, then no taxes ever, and we don't need a government. There's no need for a defense because we have an ideal world.
If we were to go for a zero corporate income tax, we would either have to raise personal taxes really dramatically, or we would see deficits that take off for the stratosphere. And, of course, the answer that I get from my Tea Party friends when I discuss this with them, as they say, we'll cut spending. And I say, tell me where?
Yeah. And that's
because all the discretionary spending, which they give me lists of things like cut welfare, cut this, cut foreign aid. Yeah, we could cut all that, and it would cut about 2% out of the budget. We would still have absolutely unsustainable deficits if we cut the corporate income tax to zero.
When you take the entitlement spending that we have, and we've been talking about this for years, you take the entitlement, that's Medicare, Medicaid, what some of that is part of the federal budget, and defense, and Social Security. You put that together, and that's more than the revenue. That's more than the revenue that is held from taxes. So any discretionary spending has to be borrowed. Well, see, there's your issue. We have to cut somewhere, and it's not going to be fun.
So, what else is new in the big wide world? Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we're broadcasting this live on Saturday, July 5th, 2014. So we have gotten exactly zero telephone calls in the last hour and a half. So I figured that, of course, it could be that no one's listening. I mean, it is like the July 5th weekend. People are probably out barbecuing and drinking beer and doing things like that. By the way, just for the record, in our little discussion a moment ago, the Tax Foundation officially says the average American pays 30% in total taxes of their wages, including for everything. I just looked it
right.
up. Okay, yeah. So I'm right. Maybe you're right, too. I don't know.
It could be we're looking at different numbers, too.
The other thing you need to watch out for, if we're going to talk about general things to watch out for. Yield reaching is still a problem. There are still people who are trying to invest with the intent of getting a higher percentage income and thinking there's a free lunch there somewhere. Unfortunately, that's not true. And it is it tends to be very, very disadvantageous to your health. It was an article in the Wall Street Journal today, or at least online today, that suggested that people were using annuities more because if you look at the payout rate on an immediate annuity when you retire, it's around 5%. And people thinking, wow, I can't get 5% anywhere else, so why shouldn't I get 5% on an annuity? Well, there's a couple of issues there. When a person retires, first off, a couple retiring today, on average, if they've got enough money to actually retire and they have enough money to make investments, they have a longer life expectancy than the average American. And so one or the other of them will live probably about 30 years after retirement today, which is one of the problems we're running into. But the issue is that you're first making a bet that the insurance company is going to survive for the next 30 years. Remember, and this is one of the things that people really, really don't get. If you have your money in a stock account at a stock brokerage firm or a custodial firm or something, the actual securities and money that you have in there up to certain limits are protected by the SIPC, which means if the company goes belly up, it goes bankrupt, it fails, it becomes insolvent, or any of those other nice things we call them, the federal government, a federal agency actually steps in and replaces your cash and securities. Now, they won't guarantee the market value of those securities, but they will replace them. If you have your money in the bank and the bank fails, obviously the FDIC steps in up to $250,000 per account and replaces the money. Cool. Well, if you have your money with an insurance company, an annuity, and the insurance company fails, who replaces your money? And the answer is quite possibly no one. There are state insurance guarantee funds, but they are quirky to say the least, and you have to have all the stars aligned before you're covered by them. And then last but not least, if you had a large-scale failure of insurance companies, just as we did at banks on a couple of occasions, and we've had in brokerage firms on other occasions, the insurance guarantee fund would not be able to pay. And there's no absolute requirement that it does pay. It's there. It is for the purpose of paying, but most states have firewalls in their laws that prevents the state treasurer from being tapped if the insurance guarantee fund can't pay for the losses. And that's the way banks used to be covered prior to the 1930s, and it didn't work particularly well. So that's the number one thing, is there's no federally backed insurance to cover your money if you have an insurance company fail and you've given them your money for an annuity. The second issue that's in there is when somebody's looking at this 5% return, that's really good, except for the fact that part of what they're getting back in that annuity is their principal. And so when you see a 5% return, it's not a return on your money, it's a return of your money. In other words, if you give me $100 and I say I'm going to give you $5 a year back because you gave me the $100, I'm going to pay you $5 a year, you could say, well, golly bum, I've got a 5% return on my money. I'm really doing really well. Well, the problem is after 20 years, what I've done is I've returned your money to you. And at that point, I stop. And if you think about the fact that this, I was actually reading a fellow who commented that he looked at immediate annuities and realized he could get a 5% return and he decided to get those rather than using a diversified investment account where you could only take out 4% a year safely.
Right.
Well, think about that just a minute. What are the chances, given that we know what happens to financial firms in the world, what are the probabilities that any given financial firm will be around 20 years from now? And it really is unknown, but in fact is not particularly high. So if over that 20-year period they paid this guy 5% on his money and then went bankrupt, what he's had is a return of his original money with no inflation factored in.
Right.
And what's more, he probably had to pay taxes on part of that as he was getting it back. So what he got back was probably about 50 to 75% of his money before it failed. And by the way, if he dies in 20 years with an immediate annuity, the same thing occurs. You know, he just simply doesn't get the money back because somebody else got the money.
Yeah, this is the deal here as well. There's a I just had this question this last week where a person had owner financed a piece of property with a house on it. And because it was owner financed, it was at a higher percentage rate than a normal mortgage would be. It was owner financed. And a lot of times when people talk about owner financing, it's because the person that they are financing, if they're selling the property, the person that they're financing can't get a mortgage somewhere else because they're a high risk. So you get a higher interest rate. So they're getting 8% interest on the mortgage. However, it's amortized. You get principal back with that interest. And this person was asking me about what to do because the mortgage got refinanced. So they're going to get a chunk of money coming in. Well, that chunk of money coming in, I said, what were you doing with the payments that you were receiving before? And this person said that they were augmenting their expenses. They were paying it to different places, paying bills, and some of it they were saving. And I said, well, what percentage were you saving? And the person did not know. It's important to recognize here, just like an annuity, when you're getting paid from a mortgage, you're getting principal as well as interest. You're getting that back. And if you spend it over the time that you're receiving it, say this person never refinanced and they just kept paying the mortgage off, eventually there would be no money left for the person that used to be the owner. They spent it all as it came in, and they had a chunk of money, and now it's all gone because they spent it as income, thinking this is an interest.
Right there is the don't ever touch the principal rule.
Right, and recognizing what is principal and what isn't is very important. And in the bond market right now, that's a big deal. In the annuity market, that's a big deal. People that buy a bond for a higher price than's on the face of the bond. It's pretty normal to do that these days. You buy a bond that's $1,100 or $1,050. That extra $100 or $50 is not going to come back to you when it matures. That means that as you go from now to maturity, you're getting less than what you think you are, and you're paying taxes as income on all of it. So that extra money that you paid is coming back as interest, and you have to pay taxes on it. There's a lot of danger involved in looking at these streams of income. Income investments are very conservative places, and so people think they're conservative. They must be safe. They're safe if you understand them, if you plan around them. They can be very unsafe. If you're talking about a high-yield bond, that's another word for junk bond. And a lot of times, what you're actually doing when you buy a high-yield bond is you're recognizing that you're not going to get the maturity value later on, so I'm going to take as much as interest now. Well, if you treat all of that interest as income, and you know your principal's at stake out there, that there's a high deal of risk on it, then you're hurting yourself again. So there's a lot of education that needs to go into income investing.
That's an understatement. The issue is, and this is, we talk about this a lot, but I still see people injured by it. And that is that if you look at the 10-year, if you're willing to leave your money alone for 10 years, and you look at the 10-year Treasury note rate, which currently is still below 3%. And whatever it is that you're putting your money into and you're getting income from is paying higher than that with a guaranteed return of your money of some kind. You are in a position of taking significant market, not just market loss, significant loss in your money and possibly losing all of it. People really don't get that. I think people a lot of times believe in their heart of hearts that it's possible to get a higher interest rate and not take risk. I don't know why that belief is so widespread, but it's there. And we've certainly seen a lot of people over the years who have learned the hard way how easy it is to lose their money. The backside to that is if you have an investment portfolio and you have it under control, and you're taking out more than 5 or at most, well, if it depends on how well it's managed and what it's managed to do, but if you're taking out more than 5 or 6% a year, you, in all likelihood, better have a short life expectancy, because somewhere down the road, presuming that you want to increase your withdrawals with inflation at some point, you're going to run out of money. And that sounds absurd to most people when I try to explain it to them. But it is, the reality is, if we have, and the average over a very, very long period of time in the United States is about a 3% inflation rate. So let's just say we have 3% inflation over the next 30 years and a 3% compound rate of inflation. And let's just say you're taking out 5%. Well, what that means is you really have an 8% withdrawal rate, because inflation is eating up 3% of your money a year on average. You're taking out 5%. That's an 8% withdrawal rate. If you look at the really, really long-term return of investments. A reasonably, the stock market itself over the very, very long term has about an 8% return on average. If you throw in some conservative positions in there with some bonds and some cash and so on, which are typical, you're getting an 8% return over a long period of time is a really quite a good conservative return. Can you get higher? Historically, yeah. If you're willing to put up with a lot of bumps in the market, you can get up around 10%. But here's the point. If you factor in inflation plus 6%, which is the upper end of what I mentioned a moment ago, you've just, and then if you've got any mathematicians out there that understand compound interest, you realize I'm going to be off just a little bit here, but it's going to be really about a 9% draw rate on your portfolio. You can't have an investment portfolio without some kind of friction, and figuring a 1% friction rate, that's fees and charges and everything else that goes on out there, now you're up to that 10% number, which is the long-term return of the stock market. And in a lot of people, for some reason, think they can do better than that. Or they don't think inflation. Well, it's funny. Some of the same people who want to take out the, a rate of return that will not allow them to adjust for inflation are the same people who are most afraid of future inflation. So it's just one of those things to bear in mind as you look at your portfolio and you consider what you're doing. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't know how much they're taking out of their portfolio each year. But I'll assure you that if it's over 5 or 6%, your probabilities of running out of money somewhere down the road get pretty high.
And good. We've got some commercials to play.
We have commercials to play, yes. And this is Saturday, July 5th, and we're probably talking to ourselves today, but that's cool. We're actually pretty good.
I talk to myself all the time.
And we'll be back after this important word from KTEM and its sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And Jake came up with some numbers that are a little different from mine on taxation, and might as well talk about that as anything else. I came up with a tax policy board saying, Tax Policy Foundation, saying that the average American pays about 30% of their income, not counting deductions or anything else. Just if you
make
for every $1,000 you make, you pay about $300 in taxes across the board total, and that's state income taxes, federal income taxes, Medicare, Medicaid, PQRST, sales tax, etc. And you came up with about a 35% number.
Yeah, right? And what I'm using some of the same numbers that you are using, and coming up with a different result. The Tax Policy Center, which is the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution, they say as far as the state and local tax revenue, and these are numbers I've got a spreadsheet on them back at the office, but the United States as a whole pays, as far as state and local taxes, about 10.34%. So that's the average person in the United States, and some people pay significantly more than that. Some people pay significantly less than that. But that's the average. So that's 10.34. The combined, and this is the same institute, this is the Tax Policy Center, the combined median income tax for, this is payroll as well as income tax, is 22.65. Well, you can add those together and see what is the number there. Well, now you're talking about 33%. And my figures, when I take the corporate tax and look at who owns corporate income and so on, and I take the income and apply the extra taxation on income there, we come up with 34.8% 5% or so, which is about 35%, which is a little too high. And a lot of that extra highness comes from the payroll side as well as the corporate side. Now, what does that mean? It could be that the numbers that we're looking at going back, because we've got so much more detail available today, and we didn't have so much detail available 20 years ago, it could be we were paying the same amount back then. So it's really hard to go forward and say what's a normal rate. What we can say is that the historical combined rate going back, say, in 1955, this is payroll taxes and income taxes, the median income, the average tax rate was 7.35% on payroll tax and income tax. And when that says something pretty clearly to me, coming forward to today, where the median person, I'm sorry, it was 20%. The median today is 22.65. We've come up a bit. Now, what does that mean? Well, that 2.65% is, it doesn't seem like a whole lot on the surface, but then you throw in the corporate rate and you're talking about a 5% increase in what we're spending as taxes over a 60-year period.
The Heritage Foundation, which is that liberal think tank.
No, they're a bit conservative, yes, I would say. Okay. Yeah.
They say that at all levels, taxation paid in the United States equates to 26.9% of the GDP.
Okay. When we're looking at tax revenue to the United States government, which is an easy one to look at, tax revenue to the United States government based on a percentage of GDP for the year 2013 is 18.6%.
Really?
Yeah. Well, okay. So when you throw in state, local, and all of that, we got to figure out, this is what what we do is we go, wait, these numbers don't match. What's going on here? Well, there's a reason why the numbers don't match. Income for the GDP is not really gross in the gross domestic product. Locally, it's net. When you're talking about the cost of purchasing and so on, and there's a lot of taxation that happens at the corporate level between the income coming in and the purchase of an item. So if you make income this year, you pay taxes on it, and you buy the item next year, the GDP doesn't recognize that very well. And so talk about some esoteric stuff, but this is the stuff that makes us happy.
The GDP amounts to the profit of the entire nation, and
right,
that's the kind of consensus. And 26.4% of our profits go to taxes at all levels, according to the Heritage Foundation. And, and so we could say then somewhere between 26 and 35% of our money goes to taxes. But that's, that varies dramatically. The more money a person makes, and a lot of people think this is a little strange, but it's true, the more money a person makes, the higher their effective tax rate becomes, the percentage that they pay in taxes. And I realize that there are people who will argue with that, but the people who are arguing with it are only looking at the federal income taxes. Because people who make more money generally have bigger houses and higher property taxes, and they pay more in sales tax and a host of other things too. But anyway, that's the numbers where they are, as I have them here from the right. Heritage Foundation.
Well, looking again, I'm looking here at GDP numbers. The revenues for 2013 were 16.7% of GDP.
Revenues of what? For the federal government?
For the federal government. Mm-hmm.
Which takes 10% to go to the local government in all of its forms and fashions,
right,
and filings.
And tax revenues on average from 1970 to 2009 to the federal government as a percentage of GDP was 18.3%.
Okay.
So that's a relatively good place to be.
And income tax revenues to the federal government of 18% seem to be fairly healthy. But we're a little below that right now, actually. I think,
right. Well, this last year, it was 16.7.
Yeah, and therein, by the way, is why we have a deficit.
Right.
We And again, I want to draw this parallel between the Old Testament, where basically 20% went to the federal government and 10% went to the local government.
And 2012, it was 15% of the GDP came to the federal government.
And therein, if you really want to understand the reason we had big deficits, it's because we had...
The revenue coming in was much lower than it needed to be.
If 20% works, or 18% works... and we only had 15%, then 3% of the GDP was missing from the flow into the government, while at the same time the government was spending a lot of extra money on little odds and ends like wars and
I have a piece of cool news that would fit in here.
Okay.
If the corporate tax rate was dropped down to 20% or 21%, the revenue on the corporate side of things would jump very significantly. And I could do a whole study on the amount it would jump. But the reason why I'm saying that is many corporations base profit centers in places overseas that have less protection for intellectual property. Microsoft has a place in Ireland, and Apple has a place in Ireland. And Ireland's intellectual property rights are much lower than the United States. The United States has the best intellectual property rights laws in the world. If you invent something here, our laws say you get to reap the benefits for quite a significant period of time. Most of the world, they say, if you get to reap the benefits, it's going to be a very short period of time. So if you spend a lot of money developing a product, and that product is based in the United States, nobody can copy it because the United States gets really upset if you break our laws when it comes to international trade. If you base that product in Ireland, you have a lot less protection. Your profits go away.
Mm.
The United States is a really, really good place to do business except for the taxes. If we had the same tax rates as most of Europe for corporations, 21%, the value in keeping the products and the profits in the United States causes us to do that. So Apple and Google and GE, and I could just keep going down the list of these major companies that have huge amounts of money overseas, would build those huge amounts of money here.
Mm-hmm.
And we also need to probably invest them here. Right. We also need to have an amnesty on bringing money back to the United States. And I know that sounds really weird. What, forgive the taxes? Well, no other country, and no other industrialized first world country, taxes its citizens and corporations on money made in other countries.
Okay. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks, gentlemen. Enjoy the show. I have a quick question. I was one of those folks, I'm getting a little older, and I got a mortgage, and I always wanted to pay it off early. But I listened to you guys, and you sold me. I got it. You know, don't pay it off. I mean, so my question is, does kind of that same principle apply? I've got, like, a rental, some investment property with a pretty good rate of interest on that mortgage. Does the same principle apply? Like, don't worry about paying that off either because of tax implication, et cetera, and then also like a small business loan, you know, if you got a reasonable interest rate against, you just go ahead and keep paying steadily as opposed to trying to pay it off early, and I'll just hang up and listen to your response.
Thank you for the call. There's a principle of finance here, and there's always exceptions, but you really have to be careful with exceptions principles. And that is, if you have something you can do with money, so you owe money at some interest rate. Now, the first thing you want to do is, when you have a loan on productive assets, and it's really important to recognize a house is a productive asset.
Right.
A car is a productive asset. A computer is a productive asset. When you have, as opposed to just having credit card debt, when you have a loan on productive assets, it's generally structured to run over the lifetime of the productive asset so that you're paying for it as you use it. Now,
that's where the word mortgage comes from. Mort means death, and gauge means measurement. It's the life expectancy or death expectancy of the property. How long will it last?
Mm-hmm. So what you want to do is look at the reason you have the loan And if you're paying for something over a reasonable life expectancy, it's probably, in most cases, a good idea to pay for it as you use it, rather than paying for it years in advance, unless you just have a powerful emotional need to do that.
And that need does exist in some people.
Right.
So don't hear us by say nobody should pay off their debt. That we're not saying that. You have to measure the amount of emotion, your well-being, your sense of security comes from being in debt or not in debt.
And then there's the issue of where have you got the money that you're going to use to pay that debt off. So let's just say that you have, and I'm going to be let's say that you have an 8% loan on something. We used that in the past. So let's say you've got an 8% loan on something. Inflation's running around 2% right now, so it's really a 6% loan to begin with. And secondly, if you are in that mysterious position that we were just talking about, and if I was roughly correct, and you're paying about 30% in taxes, but the loan interest is deductible, well, that shaves roughly a third off of your 6%. So what you've got is a real interest rate on that loan of about 4%, which is not a lot. And so the answer, then you turn around and look at where you have the money or where you could put the money. So you're going to use money to pay off this loan with, whether it be a mortgage or whatever. And that money's got to come from someplace, and it also has the potential to be used somewhere else. I think, again, good conservative rate of return in a long-term, well-diversified investment. That was a mouthful, by the way.
Right.
You probably should be able to get around an 8% return or a real return of 5% over a long period of time in a very conservative, well-diversified investment. So there's your kind of break-even. It's the 5%. If your net cost of the loan is greater than 5%, after you've figured everything in,
then you want to pay it off.
Then you might want to consider. Now, there's one other element I'm going to throw in here. You might want to consider paying it off if you just have the extra money. If you have the extra money, if you pay off the loan, it's gone.
Yeah.
But if you pay off the loan and you still have the property, you obviously could sell the property, but it's not very liquid. On the other hand, if you were to do a really broad, diversified, conservative investment and you expect over the long term to get a net after-tax rate of return of about 5%, then, again, here is the key that underlies all this. There's an assumption here, and that is an assumption that you don't need the liquidity.
Right.
Even if you have a higher interest rate, net interest rate loan, getting rid of liquidity to cover unexpected emergencies,
We call that liquidity cost.
Then, yes, at least you do.
I do. Well, yeah. I call liquidity cost what happens when your boat is sinking as well. That's liquidity cost.
Liquidity cost is the water bill I pay.
Buoyancy problems.
Yes. So you have to, all of these things have to go into consideration. And, for example, since you mentioned, let's say you have some rental property in this area and you have a mortgage outstanding on it, and the rental property has, you have to be very careful. I mentioned this a little earlier in the show. If, as it looks to be likely to happen, about 16,000 troops get pulled out of Fort Hood, what will that do to the rental economy in the Temple, Belton, Fort Hood area?
I get this often. Well, the people that live in my place, they're not soldiers. And I go, well, if the soldiers leave, then the places where they stay are empty.
Mm-hmm. So the price goes down.
Price goes down, which means that if you keep the price the same where you are, your renters will go to the place where the soldier was.
And if you're in this economy here in Central Texas, there are exceptions. There are businesses like ours, for example, that are pretty well economically independent in that many, many, many of our investors live well outside of this area.
Yes, we're well diversified across the country and the world.
So we're not selling product in this area in any form or fashion. So we're not economically dependent upon the Central Texas Metroplex, whatever it's called, Centralplex economy. However, if you have a rental property here, by definition, if the people are employed, they're employed in some business that has a connection to the local economy.
Right.
Well, not by definition, but probably. And if they are, then they could conceivably either have a pay cut or lose their jobs and need to move somewhere else to find work. So you because you mentioned specifically the issue of paying off rental property loans, if you have the cash sitting there and you can continue to make those loans until the troops come back, and they will, because in the history of the United States, and particularly, I hate to say this, in the history of Democratic administrations in the United States, there's a tendency to draw down the troop strength just in time for us to have a good war where they have to pump them back up again.
When we're looking at the problems that we're seeing in Libya, the problems that we're seeing in Iraq, the problems that we're seeing in Syria, you just keep going down the list of Afghanistan's got issues, but they're fairly well under control. But Pakistan's got a lot of problems going on up in Waziristan.
Well, there's also this little country over there called Russia.
Oh, you mean the elephant that's been standing in the room that we've been ignoring
right.
up to this point. When the international press and the American press no longer talk about Crimea because we're talking about eastern Ukraine, Russia just got a free pass to take a big chunk of its neighbor militarily.
And by the way, this last month, we increased our exports to Russia by $12 billion.
Right. They got away with it. They're fine. They're happy with that. They like the fact that there's a little fight going on in Ukraine because that takes all the attention off of Crimea. Now, I'm even saying Crimea is separate than Ukraine now because as far as maps are going, as far as the law of the land, Crimea is no longer part of Ukraine. It's gone. It is no longer part of that country. It is Russia.
It's a de facto annexation by Russia.
So there are...
by military force.
When we're talking about rental property in Central Texas, we need to consider Russia. And Russia, and I realize that's a really strange concept, but Russia is a very major factor in the price of rental real estate in Central Texas. How's that for throwing...
Yeah, it is. And that's one of the reasons we focus on the big picture. So the answer to your question as to whether you should pay off the loan depends on a lot of factors. But one of the factors,
Vladimir Putin,
that
is
I think
them.
You really need to pay attention to is if your ability to pay off that loan is based on drawing down money based on, again, an underlying assumption that your rental income will stay in place, you might want to really think about that a little bit. Because we had every major... rental property owner, and by major I mean multifamily rental property owners, apartment complex owners in central in the Fort Hood area, at least Fort Hood, Killeen, and actually going over into the Temple area,
some of Copper's Cove,
went bankrupt in 1991.
Yeah, there's another key factor here, and you were talking about liquidity, and that's important. If you have the money sitting there and you could pay off the rental property and you weren't using it for anything anyway and you don't expect to need it at all and you can let it sit there for a long period of times without dipping into it, then paying off a rental property may be something you would want to do. That's a big lot of big ifs. A big chunk of that is if the reasons why we want to pay off a rental property preclude all those things that I just said. All those things about you have a lot of money sitting there, you can pay it off, it's not going to hurt you to do so. The reason why people want to pay off rental properties early is they look at it and they say, what happens if there's no renter there? Then I'm going to lose this income coming in and I will have to pay the mortgage still.
Mm-hmm.
So they go, it's going to hurt me, I'm going to have an expense if the renter's gone.
Right.
And so they say, I'll pay it off early. Well, the problem is that if the renter's gone and you pay it off early, where did that money come from? If the expense of paying the mortgage is the reason why you did it, then you couldn't afford to pay off the house to begin with.
And this is a complex problem. But again, let's come back to principle. If you have a house that you are renting out and you're getting good income on it, and you have the opportunity to pay it off, you, in effect, are paying for the use of that house in advance.
Yeah.
You are now, with a mortgage, you're paying for the use of the house as the house is used. And hopefully your rent is higher than the cost you're paying for the house.
Right.
An awful lot of people are upside down on that, and they're feeding it, and they think they make they're making a profit when actually they're taking a loss. It is, again, a complex thing, but the bottom line to it is the central principle is you borrow money in such a way on productive property that you pay for it over its life expectancy. That is, and you really want to be very cautious about getting away from that principle. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we're about out of time on this Saturday, July 5th, 2014. Hope you're having a very, very good weekend. If you'd like to contact us off the air, leave a message, talk to us about something, come in to see us or whatever, you can either call during the week and there'll be somebody that answer, or there will be we have a voicemail on the weekend. And locally, the telephone number is 947-1111.
You can reach that same toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Again, there's somebody there on the weekends, or on the week, to answer the phone. But on the weekends, we have a very nice recording that will speak to you as if you were speaking to recordings. You can also go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, and listen to podcasts. You can read about how we do business and so on.
And you can send us an email message from there.
Right. You can. There is a contact
page.
We
are definitely in the 21st century.
Or some semblance thereof, anyway, depending on where the dateline is at any given period. you can also send us an email directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we actually use those for fodder for the radio program.
Oh, yeah. We get questions on there, and we do try to raise them on the air. The other thing is, the rest of this weekend, be very, very careful out there, folks. As this weekend winds down, there will be people driving erratically, boating erratically, and so just be aware of that.
Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.
News Radio 1400 KTEM. Serving Central Texas, KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.